The Confessions of Aleister Crowley. The Birth of a Mountaineer. In this podcast, I'll be looking at Aleister Crowley's early years as a mountaineer and how he developed his passion for the mountains. It is early in the morning, and despite the bright sunlight, it is bitterly cold. The 20th century is only a few years old, and a small group of climbers are inching their way, slowly and painfully, up the shoulders of a giant Himalayan mountain. With no breath to speak, they edge in silence up the ridge, slaves only to the wind that buffets them and the rhythm of their breathing. They do not know it, but fate has dealt them a bitter blow, and some of them will never see another dawn. At the head of that party, and climbing into an unknown world, was Aleister Crowley. Crowley is well known for his journeys into the occult, for his poetry, and for his tales of sexual experimentation and drug-taking. Yet what is not generally known about Aleister Crowley was that he was an exceptionally gifted mountaineer, and I believe that he could lay claim to the title of the foremost mountaineer of his generation. This has been forgotten in the furor of myths and half-truths that surround Aleister Crowley. And in this podcast, I would like to explore Crowley's life as a mountaineer and to answer some of the questions that inevitably haunt this charismatic man. In the world of mountaineering, there are as many legends about Aleister Crowley as there are in magical circles. He is believed to be responsible for the death of Sherpas, to have threatened the fellow climbers with a revolver to prevent them from retreating, and to have broken the leg of another Sherpa to prevent him from leaving the mountain. But he is also reputed to have committed the greatest sin of all amongst mountaineers, and that is to have left fellow climbers to die on K2. So in this podcast, I'd like to find out the truth behind these legends around Crowley and to explore his status as a mountaineer. Crowley remains a controversial figure, even in the 21st century. His reputation as a follower of what we might call today black magic or sorcery, his experimentation with drugs and sexual excesses have meant that he is a figure reviled by many. From considering some of the words written about himself in his own confessions and the words written about him by others in their biographies, I want to try and examine who Crowley was as a mountaineer and to follow some of his journeys in the mountains. My view is that Crowley's early life played an inextricable part in shaping his character in the future. And so let's take a look at those early years. Crowley was born in 1875, the son of Edward Crowley, a lay preacher in the Plymouth Brethren, a devout and austere faith. The Crowley family were relatively wealthy, having inherited from Aleister Crowley's grandfather a large fortune from Crowley's grandfather, who was a brewer. Crowley enjoyed in his early years wandering the lanes of Warwickshire with his father, where they preached to all who would listen. It's clear from his early writings that he very much admired his father and took great joy in his company. Certainly his ambitions as a young boy would, I think, have been to follow his father into the ministry. All this changed, however, and changed very abruptly when Crowley was aged 11 and his father suddenly died of cancer of the tongue. That had a profound effect on the young boy, not only losing his father, but suddenly his life changed completely. His mother moved from rural Warwickshire into London to be closer to her brother Thomas, and there she and the boy's uncle tried to raise him. That proved to be a very challenging task. In writing about Thomas, it's clear that Crowley despised the man from the outset. Although I think if you read between the lines, it's actually fairly obvious that Thomas did his best to bring up the young boy. But as far as Aleister Crowley was concerned, he was no substitute for his father. Life after the death of his father became a transition from one public school to another. Whereas Crowley had been a model pupil before the death of his father, suddenly he was a rebel and a renegade, moving from one Victorian public school to another. Victorian public schools in those days must have been fairly brutal and dark places. Crowley, with his dislike of sport and his unorthodox views, was the target immediately for bullying. In fact, Crowley described those years as a boyhood in hell. And he wrote these lines, which I think amply illustrate just how unhappy he was. He spoke of the School for the Sons of the Brethren at 51 Bateman Street, Cambridge. May God bite into the bones of men the pain of that hell on earth, that by them it may be sowed with the salt, accursed forever. May the maiden that passes it be barren, and the pregnant woman that behold it abhorred. May the birds of the air refuse to fly over it. May it stand as a curse, as a fear, as an hate among men. May the wicked dwell therein. May the light of the sun be withheld therefrom, and the light of the moon not lighten it. May it become the home of the shells of the dead, and may the demons of the pit inhabit it. May it be accursed, accursed, accursed forever. When all failed, and it became clear that there was perhaps no public school in England that could tolerate a pupil like Aleister Crowley, a number of governors were brought in to teach the boy various athletic pursuits and to try to lead him onto the straight and narrow. Some were clearly quite good men who coped as well as they could. Others led Crowley completely the other way, much to his enjoyment, I think. But it was around this time that Crowley began to find joy in the outdoors. And it's really here that his mountaineering began. As a teenager, Crowley began to climb on the cliffs of Beachy Head. Beachy Head is a sea cliff. The cliffs of Beachy Head are unusual in that they are high chalk cliffs. Now, chalk's quite an unusual rock to climb on, and it perhaps shaped Crowley's style of climbing for the rest of his life. One can't rely on firm holds on chalk, and indeed, I think very few people climb on chalk these days. But in the Victorian period, Crowley was certainly pioneering routes upon the cliffs of Beachy Head. And in the logbooks, you'll see, I think one of his climbs is called Esmeralda's Pinnacle. Still in the pages of the Scottish Mountaineering Club Journal are descriptions of this route and diagrams of Crowley's early climbs. It's clear that he found escape in mountaineering, and that in nature and in the natural world around him, he found a relief from the dark, drab experiences that his teenage years had brought to him. I always yearned for the beauty of nature. My only friends were the skies, the streams, the mountains and the seas. My grand passion was Beachy Head. The fantastic beauty of the cliffs can never be understood by anyone who has not grappled with them. Rock scenery depends largely on the foreground. This is especially the case when one has acquired an intimate knowledge of the meaning, from the climber's point of view, of what the eyes tell one. The only chalk in England which is worth reading is that of Beachy Head. Beachy Head offers rock problems of as very interesting and picturesque as any on the cliffs of the world. I began to explore the face. My happiest moments were when I was alone in the mountains. The beauty of form and colour and the physical exertion of exercise and the mental stimulation of finding one's way in difficult country formed the sole elements of my rapture. Crowley spent many days developing his skills on the chalk cliffs of Beachy Head, and from there he branched out up towards the Lake District and off into Scotland. But it was Wastdale Head, a small valley surrounded by the high cliffs of mountains like Great Gable and Scarfell, buried in the Lake District, where he was to consolidate his experience and begin to become the mountaineer he was to develop into. Wastdale Head was, in those years, the cradle of British mountaineering. And there he met other climbers, such as Norman Colley, men who were to pass into legend for the feats that they performed. Climbers are often defined not just by the routes that they complete, but also by the partnerships, the climbing partnerships that they form. And it was in Wastdale Head that Crowley first met the man who was to be his climbing partner for many years and who was to shape his technique in the mountains. It was there that he met Oscar Eckenstein. Eckenstein was a railway engineer. At the time they met, he was vastly more experienced as a mountaineer than Crowley. And there is no doubt that in many ways his advice and his encouragement shaped Crowley as a mountaineer. For his part, Crowley greatly admired him and said of him, "Eckenstein was a finished athlete. His right arm in particular was so strong that he had only to get a couple of fingers onto a sloping ledge of an overhanging rock above his head, and he could draw himself up slowly by that alone. He was short and sturdily built. His climbing was invariably clean, orderly, and intelligible. Mine can hardly be described as human. His movements were a series, mine were continuous. He used definite muscles. I used my whole body." Eckenstein made a number of contributions to modern mountaineering. He's credited with developing a style of climbing that is used by modern climbers, which is essentially balance climbing. In the Victorian days, climbers would use pretty well any part of their body and almost kind of smear themselves on the rock so that their clothing and any friction they could obtain would hold them on the rock. Eckenstein developed balance climbing, whereby climbers use their feet and hands and delicately balance themselves up the rock, which is essentially how climbers move today. He's also credited with developing an early crampon, which some 50 years later was to revolutionise mountaineering. Together with Eckenstein, Crowley began to develop his climbing abilities in wider ranges, and they very quickly moved to climbing in the Alps, where Eckenstein was already experienced. Again, as usual, Crowley courted controversy. Many of the ascents made by leading mountaineers at that time were in fact made using local guides to show the way and to assist in the climbing. Crowley poured scorn on that technique and preferred to climb guideless. This in fact brought him into a lot of conflict with the Alpine Cub, and he and Eckenstein, the enfant terrible of the climbing fraternity of their day, and many of their achievements were never acknowledged by the Alpine Club. Crowley, for his part, had no respect for tradition or for the strictures that the Alpine Club tried to place around him. He was never a member at all and was at odds with them for the rest of his life. In the years between 1894 and 1898, Crowley spent his summers climbing in the Alps, either with Eckenstein or with other partners he could meet up with. I could find no exhaustive record of the climbs that he made, but it's clear that he climbed many of the famous peaks of the Alps, including climbs of the Matterhorn, the Monk, the Jungfrau, and the Dent Blanche. I climbed the Dent Blanche myself many years ago now, and it's odd to think now, looking back, that I was actually walking in the steps of Crowley when I did it. It's very clear that Crowley, in the space of only a few years, became a very expert climber and mountaineer, easily tackling what were the hardest routes at the time in the Alps. In his confessions, he relates some interesting tales that concern his alpine climbing. "The Vieubier Serac constituted one of the most interesting ice climbs I've ever done. They had not been climbed for a generation, and then when the glacier was in very different condition and were reputedly impossible. The best guide in the valley and other Alpine Club members decided to attempt it. They returned with wonderful stories of desperate adventure. They had been stopped, they said, by the final obstacle, an overhanging ice wall guarded by a wide crevasse. This at once caught my attention. The following morning we set out and reached the obstacle that had defeated them without difficulty. But we could not be surprised at their failure to negotiate the obstacle, before we found ourselves standing on a knife edge, separated from the overhanging ice wall by a crevasse, so broad that we could only just reach it with our axes. One of our party, Travis, leaned across the crevasse, and I used him as a bridge, and stood for 40 minutes, cutting holes above him, on his shoulders. Thus we negotiated the serac. Thus we negotiated the ice wall. We now found that far from this obstacle being the last, it was the first. Began to be not a little alarmed. The serac stretched above me line after line. There was no way of escape, and at any moment the sun might strike the glacier above us and bring the seracs down upon us and crush our pride and our temerity, climbed with desperate haste, and managed to reach the snow-covered glacier above them just in time. A party that had gone out from the hotel after breakfast with the idea of watching us told us that evening that our tracks had been obliterated in a dozen places by falling ice. That remains one of my most memorable ice climbs.
Crawley relates a number of interesting tales from his adventures in the Alps, and here's just one of them. We had made the second ascent of the north-northeast ridge of Mount Colon. It's a long and severe climb. The conditions were bad, and I had to pull Gregor most of the way. We were very late on the mountain in consequence, and I struggled to find the best way down. However, we reached the glacier safe enough, but it was late. We took off the rope and descended some slopes with loose rock. As I sat down to coil the rope, I realized I was completely exhausted, or mentally rather than physically. Then my brain played me a curious trick. Suddenly I saw a troll, one of those fine little dwarfs with pointed caps and formidable beards that one sees pictured on fairy stories. This creature was hopping about on the rocks in a very jovial way. He appeared quite real in every respect. He was not transparent, but it never occurred to me to believe in him. I put him down to cerebral fatigue. The apparition only lasted a few minutes, and he was gone before I rejoined my cousin. Crawley relates another tale with obvious amusement. One of his frequent climbing partners was a man called Travers. Oddly, I also climbed with a man called Travers. However, they'd spent a week or so wandering about in the Oberland, mostly in above the snow line. But they became very badly sunburned. Sunburn in high altitudes is a major problem. And Crawley says, in those days we cherished the superstition that lanolin was a preventative, but the application seemed to feed the sores instead of healing them. After a few days, he arrived at the Gornograt, where he had dispatched his baggage, in fluttering rags with a face that was little better than one single suppurating sore. A lady sitting outside the hotel exclaimed indignantly that such disgusting objects should not be allowed to frequent public places. It was his mother. By the turn of the century, Crawley was an accomplished alpine mountaineer. He had climbed many of the major peaks in the Alps, repeated new routes, and set routes of his own. Now, he considered, it was time to move on to the greater ranges of Mexico and the Himalayas. And it's here that his reputation as a mountaineer is founded. I'll be looking at Crawley's Himalayan climbing in my next episode, where I'll also be examining some of the myths and legends that remain so much a part of the mystique of the mountaineer, Alistair Crawley.
And you can see John Burns in his play Alistair Crawley, A Passion for Evil, at the Edinburgh Fringe between the 6th of August and the 28th of August. John will be appearing at the Sea Venues in Chambers Street, Edinburgh. Tickets will be available shortly when the Edinburgh Fringe website goes live.